Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 38 for March 11th, 2013. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I am happy to have you with me as always. This episode is the first of several interviews that I recorded over the last few days with some of the smartest people that I know in and around the video game industry. I collected a bunch of journalists and critics and developers to chat with me about the state of games, which is a sort of whoppingly big topic and probably impossible to address comprehensively, but we give it a shot anyway. It seems to me that we're in a major transitional period, and I found in these conversations that my guests agree. All three console manufacturers are releasing or have released brand new hardware. We're seeing a major reemergence of PC gaming on Steam and other distribution channels. That seems to be significantly impacting how developers get their games to us and how we shop for and buy games. The rise of the indie gaming scene has changed the landscape forever, I think, even to the degree of redefining what games are. Social media has altered our conversations about games with each other and with the people who build and sell them. Of course, mobile games on smartphones and tablets have exploded in popularity. It's easy to forget that these hardly even existed a few years ago. So it seems like a good time to examine and reflect on all this. And that's what I've tried to do in these roundtable conversations. So, I'll lead off with two people whose writing I greatly admire, Lee Alexander and Brendan Keough. I'll introduce them properly in the segment, so I won't repeat myself here, but it's fair to say that both Lee and Brendan are at the forefront of thinking about games as culture and as significant forms of creative expression. I hope you'll check out my website for links to their work, and I want to thank both Lee and Brendan for taking time to chat with me. One more note before I segue to the show. I had a mic problem on my end about 40 minutes into the recording. It lasts about 8 minutes. Before I realized the problem, I fixed it. You'll notice I sound a little distant in the audio during those 8 minutes. Fortunately, the mic on my computer picked up the slack that my external mic didn't get, so I didn't lose my audio during that time. I just don't sound very good during those minutes, and I apologize for that problem. Lee and Brendan's audio were unaffected by that. So, sorry for the problem, but I think you'll still enjoy the show. I hope you do. Thanks again, as always, for joining me, and away we go. It is a great pleasure to welcome Brendan Keough and Lee Alexander to the podcast. Lee, for what I should have counted before I started this many times, Lee's joined me. And always great to have you with me, Lee. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. It's always a huge pleasure. This is actually one of my favorite engagements.
Ah, well, mine too. I get emails. I know I mentioned it to you casually that I do get emails from people who listen to the podcast, and usually they're people who've listened to it for a long time. And they'll, I would say, you know, about once a month, I'll get an email from someone. When will you have Lee on again? When will Lee be on the podcast again?
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah. And of course, Brendan Keough, this is your debut appearance on the show, which seems kind of crazy because you've been making a big splash as a game critic and journalist for quite a long time now. It's a terrific chance to get you on the show. I seized it. Grateful you're here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's a huge privilege to be here.
Well, Brendan is a freelance writer. He's a critic, a journalist. If you haven't seen his work, you haven't been paying attention, man. You've got to get on the ball. He's written for a variety of websites, publications, Edge Magazine, Paste, Unwinnable. He is currently a PhD candidate at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. In the media and communications program, right?
That's it. Exactly right.
And Lee, I guess probably everyone listening already knows about Lee. She is editor at large at Gamma Sutra. She also writes a column for Kotaku, a monthly column, as well as a monthly column for Edge magazine. And her work has appeared all over the place. Variety, Slate, LA Times.
Yeah, I did some Pace stuff back in the day. I do a column, actually, if you don't mind me plugging it real quick, because I'm excited about it. At Vice's Creators Project, I do a column that's sort of writing about interesting creators. You can find it at Vice Creators Project, and it's called Gamer's Paradise. And I get to sort of profile indies from the perspective of just being general creative people. It's kind of for a non-gamer audience, so I find that fun.
That's fantastic. You know, you are branching out. You're sort of a culture critic, culture writer as well, you know, not just video games. And I have to confess, I used to introduce you on the show just right off the top of my head because I knew what you were doing. I, you know, follow you pretty easily. Now I actually had to go to LinkedIn and look at your profile because there's
my LinkedIn is even out of date, Michael. I can't even remember. Well, seriously, it's sometimes I just say I write a lot of stuff. I've been writing at Boing Boing, general tech culture and some television stuff. I've been writing about Black Mirror, the UK TV show, and I write about Game of Thrones there, and I write at Thought Catalog. I do some essays and culture stuff for the millennials.
Yeah, I love your Thought Catalog stuff because it gives me the sort of temporary illusion that I'm hip and with it, which is cool.
You are completely hip.
Yeah.
If anyone is hip, you are hip.
Well, once again, thanks for coming on. It's great to have you. And in particular, the topic that I'm exploring, and this is, I'll just mention this is the first recording that I'm making in this little mini series of roundtable sessions that I'm having with some of the smartest people I know, writers, critics, developers around the game industry. And the whole conversation is really kind of under the rubric of the state of games. Which I guess could be a little bit of a pretentious title, but it really is just an attempt to sort of say, let's take a snapshot of where we are and, you know, what do we think about it? Where are we headed? And, you know, sort of the state of games. I think it actually, we bandy about this, it's a transitional time or, you know, things are changing and it's a milestone year or whatever you hear it regularly mentioned. But I really do think that we are in a transitional time now with the new consoles coming and all kinds of other reasons we can explore. So I just thought this is a real good time to gather some people around to chat about it. So that's why we're here. So let's begin. Maybe just a good way to start this would be to kind of ask both of you the general question. Do you find yourself in general hopeful about where the video game industry is headed? Do you have concerns about where it's headed? What's your sort of general barometer as you would gauge it from your own particular view? Brenna, why don't we start with you?
It's a tricky one because I really see it going in both directions at once. On one hand, I'm really, really excited about all the different strands of game creation that there are out there, like more than just indie and mainstream. You now have all the different strands and layers of indie development, from your kind of little homebrew Twine games up to your really big, almost double A, I guess, indie games and stuff. So that's really exciting on that side. And it's really exciting seeing a whole lot of big AAA studio titles trying to approach more interesting themes and being more self-reflective. But then at the same time, there's all the anxieties about all the issues that just don't seem to go away, like the, you know, obviously the treatment of women in games and all those things that are still the same issues now that there were several years ago and they don't seem to be going away. So on one hand, I'm really excited about all the new types of games that are existing. It's really exciting ecology of games. But on the other hand, it's like, why are we still talking about the same stuff? And some parts don't look like they're progressing. So I have very conflicted views on it, I think.
Do you separate, I mean, as I hear you talk about this, I'm hearing you say there's a branch of this that's really just about the business and the industry and building things to sell to people. And the other side of it is the culture, the community, the people who write about games, buy games, get on forums and talk about games. And there's and the people who hire people to work on games, that there's an ugly side to that that hasn't gotten any better.
I think I find that tension perhaps maybe the most interesting thing to me with games at present, like that real tension between being a consumer good and being a creative cultural art form. It seems to be something that all the different, I guess, tiers of or strands of game design seem to be struggling with, and especially the writers around games seem to be struggling with as well.
Yeah.
So I find that just a really interesting tension at the moment.
You mentioned the art form. Is this question, argument finally been made and proven that we don't have to have this conversation about games or art, or should we consider them in artful conversations?
It's almost the next consequence of that. It's like, well, they are art, so now we have to consider all these other things. So that implies.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's almost better if they aren't art in a way, right? Because if they are, then suddenly you have a totally different kind of conversation, right?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the conversations we've been having the last year or so have been really, now that we're acknowledging that games are making some kind of contribution to culture in some kind of important way, that we need to be more, I guess, vigilant about what that contribution is that different games are making. And I think especially around all the conversations around video game violence, and I think Lee wrote one of a really good blog posts about it, amongst other people, just realizing that we've always had a very kind of black and white idea of video game violence. We all defend it. And now we're like, well, actually, if we're saying video games matter culturally, then this might be a bit more gray and ambiguous than we've previously thought about it.
I definitely agree with Brendan in that, you know, I think that what we're in now is nothing short of probably the biggest upheaval we've ever seen as a business and as a culture. And it's getting to be where the idea of games now encompasses so many different audiences and so many different approaches that, you know, people that, you know, I used to consider, colleagues of mine, that we're doing the same work. And now we are absolutely not. We're speaking to completely different and equally valid audiences for completely different and equally valid reasons. And it's been a very observable transition where, you know, when I started playing games in the early 80s, it was absolutely a product culture where you could evaluate things in categories of five with scores of, you know, allocate points to the categories. And games are a product that you sell on shelves, and their job is to sort of demonstrate and maximize a hardware product. And it was very much always a product culture. And then, you know, toward the middle of the last decade, we started saying, well, these experiences are, you know, do they matter to people? But I think the space has just fragmented so massively in recent years with the rise of social media. And we have interactivity now in every part of our lives. Almost everyone now is owning a smartphone or is interactive in the way that they use the web. And games have actually stealthily, I think, kind of led that. Games are, you know, one of the most popular categories on the App Store after books. And so, you know, with that sort of proliferation of interactive entertainment across every platform that we use for everything, I think being able to even say games as product versus games as art is too reductive. They're absolutely present in every facet of our culture now. And I think there are a lot of interesting questions saying, well, what is the purpose of this and for whom is it being made? And that question isn't always going to have the same answer depending on whom you ask. So there's an absolute culture war going on. You know, there are people who would consider themselves gamers. They want a console. And then there are people who are interested in social simulation and in text games. And there are people who are seeing games as a completely valid form of individualized self-expression, like Brendan mentioned, like the Twine game scene, people who are writing basically interactive personal essays as a form of gaming and using play to communicate. I think that the idea of games has become much bigger than industry or much bigger than product, and it's actually becoming a forerunning venue for us to express ourselves in modern society. And, you know, some people are going to see it that way. Other people are going to see it as diversion or escapism. And some people are going to, you know, want interactive cinema. And it's incredibly complicated if you're interested in participating in or writing about the scene. We're having to know and define our audience, you know, to an extent we really haven't had to do in the past. And it's not always going to have the same, you know, there's no such word as gamer anymore. We're not all the same audience. You know, for me, I see myself as someone who's interested in the culture of interactive entertainment. And that can take hundreds and hundreds of different forms depending on whether I'm in a living room or I'm on an iPhone or I'm on Facebook or whether I'm at a conference for game developers. It's just gotten massive. And I think, As Brendan said, there's a lot of friction and ambivalence about that because so many people have been proud of their experience and their identity in games and seen it as a singular cultural experience that they have to share with everyone else. And now seeing it as something that doesn't belong only to them or isn't going to be constrained within the bounds of familiar expectation. I think it's actually, I mean, I've been using the word culture war more and more because, I mean, if you look at Twitter, the things that people are arguing about or talking about, they're not talking about as much about the games they're excited about. They're talking about the issues in those games that offend them or enervate them or upset them. Or they're talking about their deep investment in the way that games are covered and discussed. Like, the most heated arguments in my feed right now are about gender issues and games journalism, which I think is sort of telling in that we're interested in communication and representation right now, even more than perhaps we're interested in the products themselves.
Is this a healthy conflict? Does it have an outcome that in the long run turns out to be positive, do you think?
I think Lee made the excellent point there about it, everyone having different, totally valid audiences. And I guess the outcome is, as writers, that get better at knowing exactly which part of that audience we're addressing with each piece we write, or what part of that massive conflicting culture we're talking to. Because I think a lot of the big debates, especially the game journalism ones, people are like, oh, that's writing isn't telling me what I want to know. And it's like, well, that's because it's actually addressing this other thing from this other audience. So I don't think either side's going to win these culture wars, and it's going to end up being one or the other. I think we need to just acknowledge that fracturing is the way it is almost.
And it's actually, as I sort of touched on, it's on parallel with what's happening with the rest of what we consume online. You see content democratization happening in, culture content and news, and like sites are shifting highly to user-generated content models. And we have this incredibly fragment, these tiny fragments now. There are no longer these market segments. There are, just massive spectrums of individual voices. And, I think it's actually a victory for us that games are in step, if not ahead of the curve, in terms of the entertainment consumer, the ways that we consume entertainment of any kind and the way that we communicate about it is democratizing, and it's changing across all platforms. And I think it's probably telling about the relevance of games that they're sort of leading that charge, and that games are, being more complex or more interactive than the static media that we're working with in that way. I think it's not just that we've arrived, it's that we are sort of shaping now. And I think that's really important.
I imagine these arguments are kind of like the sorts of arguments that occurred across the arts in nascent years, where you'd have it's sort of manifesto wars and philosophical wars. And I don't mean wars as in like people are, being destroyed, but more just passionately held views sort of whizzing past your head as you listen to it. I find that for me, I used to be significantly more active on Twitter because I found it manageable that I could have conversations about what we talked about back then was, whether the third level of Game X had good pathfinding or not, and then people get all heated up about it. But now the arguments are so heated so often and so vehement, and half of me thinks this is good. This is very important that people are. This is a conversation that needs to happen. But then other times I think, God, Twitter is the worst place for this to happen, and I just can't. Yeah. I can't manage it. It's too much for me.
It's very bad for my emotional health as well, and I'm actually sort of. It's taken me a long time to try to learn to manage that volume and to be selective about who I feel I'm speaking to and who I take feedback from. It's very stressful. I think, in line with what I was just saying, the fact that we have such access to one another and such overexposure to issues and information is sort of a challenge for, any industry that is about reaching people interactively.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm trying and failing, but trying to use Twitter a lot less for exactly these reasons. I just get too involved in every small fight, which I really do not need to spend my time being involved in. But at the same time, it's an excellent tool for just having conversations we wouldn't be having, but it's exactly the place you don't want to have those conversations. So it's very difficult.
Well, and you're so every mistake one makes is instantly. I'm thinking today, probably reading about Polygon's the whole brouhaha about their review of SimCity and whether they did it right or whether they shouldn't have done it the way they did it. And there's sort of a collection of mercenaries that are just jump on these things and just hammer you. Like I watched people just get eviscerated online and it's happening in real time. I mean, I'm sure people are sitting around tables asking each other, should we do this? Should we not do this as a kind of business thing? And as those conversations are happening, there are these, it's all a fishbowl. Everything happens with people sort of waiting to see what move is made next. And then bam, here comes the criticism. And then the defenders jump in and
It's a noise machine. Yeah.
Mm. And it really, again, like all those different factoring of video games that we talked about earlier, just all gets boiled down to one thing. So it seems like every tweet is trying to address everything, which inevitably angers a lot of people, which is always an issue. But yeah. And
we're talking about, first of all, we're constrained to 140 characters, so we're not even able to make statements of particular depth or meaning. And then, you know, if you're going to use long-form writing as, you know, as conversation, then at what point are you using your skills as a writer to engender circular arguments versus to, you know, make a contribution to the conversation about games? Like, I feel right now we're spending more time talking about ourselves as players and about the culture of games than we are talking about games. And you know, it's not, I'm not immune to this. I think a lot of my articles lately have been like, you know, reactions to snafus, and, you know, I step in and try to help moderate a discussion. Then I'm like, well, when's the last time I like played a game and had a response to a game? You know, yeah. So it's like, it just sort of tells me that we're very concerned right now with who we are as a population and who our neighbors are and who our industry is. And that's probably, I think, more important to those of us who are, seems to be more important to those of us who are passionate about this than, you know, the product itself, which is interesting.
Definitely.
There is a part of me, though, and I, everything we've said, I think, is I find myself frustrated for the very reasons that you describe. And then there's another part of me that's just, I'm so jealous of the passion that games foster. And I wish I could get a whiff of that in my actual profession, my discipline, which is theater. Mm-hmm. I mean, people.
Yeah, do they have arguments? No. Can you imagine Twitter arguments about the school production? Like, you know, passive-aggressive subtweets about the stage management?
That's just it. I mean, yeah, production. Like, but it did happen once upon a time. I mean, you know about this, Lee. I mean, there were people who threw things at actors in the middle of a production. People, I mean, riots broke out, you know, at Rite of Spring, right? Because people felt they were seeing something so, you know, it just got them so flamed up. And there's a big part of me that actually, I'm jealous of it from that perspective, because people do actually care a lot, and they're very invested in it.
I wonder though, it makes me wonder, do people really care that much, or are they just addicted to the call and response of being involved?
Yeah, that's a good question.
You know, as gamers, we're people who, when we press a button, something happens. When we attack something, it attacks back. I don't like the word addicted, but we are acclimated to and gratified by the call and response of interactivity. And if you notice, like, the ways that we use Facebook and Twitter, you see, like, that red number pops up with your notifications and you have to clear it. It sort of, like, plays into our gamer mind, I think, to be on the vanguard of these RTS battles that are Twitter arguments. And it's like, is this salving our urge to play? Are these conversations salving our urge to play so that we don't actually care about playing anymore? That I really wonder that a lot.
Yeah, I have to confess, from me, that's partly why I've pulled the plug a little. As I what was actually happening to me, Brendan, I don't know if this, you feel, because you tend to get much more involved in kind of detailed conversations than I do.
Yeah, I actually envy Brendan's resolve in digging into those always.
And I often find myself rooting for you. You know what I mean? You're kind of fighting the good fight, if you know what I mean. Like, you tend to, you know, but I find that the pure pleasure of gaming, broadly defined, I could be playing Proteus or I could be playing MLB The Show. If I spend too much time on Twitter in that 48-hour period after a game launches, my desire to play Game X will diminish. It's something, it's sort of like it gets polluted, and all these people.
Is our over affinity for dialogue actually harming our relationship to our medium?
Well, it certainly it made me try to find a more pure kind of personal engagement. I'm happy to engage and hear what people have to say, but I mean, the instantaneous deconstruction of games moments after they're released is more than I can manage.
I think, because what it taps into is, it is like when you can have an in-person conversation with another game person about a game, it can be the best thing. That's why I fork out the money to go to GDC every year almost. It's just so good to just sit down with people and talk about a game in real time, which I think is maybe the lure of Twitter. But then it doesn't really work on Twitter because everybody's trying to talk at the same time and you have that word limit, which means I end up writing one sentence over three tweets. And yeah, so I think we all just have that desire to just talk about these things because there's so much to say about them. But the only what place we have to do that isn't a good place to do that. It becomes a bloodbath a bit.
Are there designers, studios, publishers, in your view, that seem to understand this persistent conversation, social media-driven thing, and are using it for good? They're leveraging it in positive ways that you've seen?
No, and this is actually one of the problems that I have right now, is that the marketing, at least behind the AAA games, is so behind listening to who we are and what we care about, and they're still sort of using the same marketing tactics. And I see, you know, many of the games press are still responding to them in the same way, and they're still, like, unifying under these media embargoes to publish their hands-on impressions and screenshots in a way that was orchestrated by a marketing team. And that cycle sort of frustrates me, because it shows that, you know, either they don't understand us, you know, the marketing teams don't understand us, they're not listening. I don't feel that there's any polling of the dialogue that we're doing, and that we might just be cyclically sort of like yelling into this wind tunnel that only we care about, which kind of scares me.
Yeah, I get that feeling a lot, that we might just be in an echo chamber. I have that issue with social media a lot. I'm like, should I block this terrible person that I don't want to talk to? But at the same time, am I just making this wind tunnel insular chamber all the more tighter, and no one's hearing what we actually have to say?
Yeah.
You know, I have this crazy idea. It would actually be sort of fun, because so many of us like role-playing games. We should, for a week, all trade personas. So, like, because we know each other so well, and I know how people
really
are going to respond.
I'm scared of this idea.
And you could choose someone to be for a week, and someone would choose you, and you would just write as they would write, respond to issues as they would respond. Because, I mean, I don't mean to I'm not mean-spirited about it, but I often find that people know I know exactly what they're going to say. People do have access to Grind. There is maybe there's an upside. I mean, I'm thinking of someone like Maddie Bryce. You both know. So here's a person who comes along. She's very interested in games, sort of slowly works her way into the social media networking with people, getting to know people. And then if you go to a thing, you might meet her. So I met her at GDC last year, for example. But she has a particular series of concerns that she's pursuing. And from what I can tell, the industry, big fat word, but, you know, the people who make decisions and care about where we're going have invited her into a conversation, and she's becoming a productive, enthusiastic, critical voice that I think is healthy, that there are people who really want to include her and other people's perspectives in these conversations.
And they learn about issues they wouldn't have previously considered because she's being outspoken.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the positive side of things like Twitter is, yeah, it gives exposure to those people and those voices that you might not have previously been able to find. And Matty is, yeah, the best example of that almost. She's kind of just one day just walked into Twitter, then all of a sudden she was there. And it was amazing. And I wouldn't know anyone.
I'm chuckling not to belittle her. I'm chuckling because I'm really fond of her and I really admire her attitude.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I think about an event like IndieCade or GDC or these other sort of gatherings of the tribe, different subsections of the tribe, maybe it's becoming difficult for the reasons you guys are all describing to know where or how to make a difference in this industry, which has become this huge, big, fat pipe that there's so many streams flowing so fast all at once, and some of them can hardly even be described as games, that maybe we shouldn't think about this as a kind of monolithic thing anymore. Maybe we should think of it as a tree with lots of branches, and really the best that any of us can do is kind of occupy or keep our eye on a few of those branches and just hope other people have their eye on the other stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to say. I agree with you completely. Like the whole, that's what I say, that we have such a fragmented spectrum now that we can't really ever assume that we're all under the same umbrella.
Mm. And it's funny, like when I first started writing about games, just as a blogger a few years ago, I was like writing these big grand statements about games do this or games should do that. And then it didn't take me long to realize that was just terrible and it wasn't really saying anything. And now I really try and sometimes succeed, but rarely, to just focus on specific games. I just write an article about one game or one cultural thing around one game because you just focus on that one little branch. And if everyone's focusing on one little branch, then together we're talking about the tree. And instead of everybody trying to describe the entire tree, to stretch that metaphor. But I just think about really specific kind of descriptive writing is just so much better.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with you as well, because it doesn't, you know, when five websites all have a review of the same product and it's geared at giving an objective valuation of how well this product works, I think it misses a large part of the, not only does it miss a large part of the experience, but it misses a lot of what, you know, people with feelings would really have to say about them. And I think, I mean, obviously there's an appetite in the readership for that subjectivity. I think some of the most popular pieces in recent years have just been individuals talking about how games fit in the context of their own lives, and readers have really seemed to respond to some of that writing.
Mm.
It sounds like it's becoming just like another academic discipline to me.
Yeah.
That if you look at how that flows out historically, you get increasing degrees of specialization with people who occupy sort of smaller and smaller patches of turf with sort of mastery or expertise over those things, which I think that's cool, because that means that someone like Brendan can write long form criticism, real ambitious, penetrating criticism about one game, Spec Ops: The Line. I imagine most people listening know about this, but if they don't, they should definitely check it out. It's ambitious, and I think it's pioneering for what that's worth. But I guess I still think we need someone kind of at the meta level who can continue to think about games kind of broadly defined, and that encompassing all kinds of media.
I tried to do both, you know, and, you know, depending on my level of interest, but, you know, I will write, you know, pretty specifically about one game or one game designer or one designer's body of work, or, and then, you know, I also try to do sort of sociological looks at things that are happening in the industry. I'm really, really just interested in the relationships between, you know, mobile games and the ways we use social media, and the way that the new business models are changing our interactions and things like that. I mean, there's so much to say. And I think, you know, we probably, all of us, myself included, would do well not to get distracted by definitions or to assume that everyone's gonna have the same angle of approach.
Yeah,
I think it's really important. And I think I'm guilty. I think I just did this 2 minutes ago. Is like to not say all kinds of writing should be this kind of writing. Because, there's so many different totally valid ways to approach talking about games and the societies and cultures and industry around games. So there's so many ways that need to, that they need to be approached. One way of writing about them isn't going to cover everything.
Yeah. So as you look ahead, I presume this all continues to sort of stay complicated and go in a million different directions. What about that picture do you find most exciting? Where are we headed that, or where do you hope we go that would make you feel like something important's happening?
I think the area I'm most excited about and have been most excited about recently are largely the games that aren't concerned about having to be games, that are just these things that just exist and just happen to be games. So I'm thinking largely experiential games like Proteus or Dear Esther or Journey to an extent, and more so the a lot of the games coming out of the queer gaming scene, like Anamphibes, Dysphoria, or again, the Twine games, or Merrick Copus's Limb. I'm really, really excited about these games that are just creative things that artists essentially have made without any real concern of how gamey it is. And to me, they're the easily just the most exciting video games that exist, just because they're what the person who made them wanted them to be. So I'm really excited to see how that kind of strand goes in the coming years of just people making things they want to make, because I find that really exciting.
What about you, Lee?
I'm also interested in those elements in which, you know, we've always talked about, you know, games are interactive and they have something to say. And my favorite games have always been ones that really strongly conveyed a vision, that clearly had a person behind them, whether or not they were like fine products or like great graphics or highly saleable console software. And now tools are so accessible and business models are so accessible. Like, you know, it's getting easier and easier to put something on Steam or to put something, you know, on the Android market that you made yourself by hand that, you know, says something about who you are. And I think that's really showing what the medium is capable of. And you know, I use the word medium then because when people are using games to communicate with others, you know, we don't even have to ask, like, is that art or not? It almost, you know, it almost doesn't matter. But in terms of commercial games, I am really interested in the sort of junction that's happening between games and life. Like, I found it, I did a post on Sexy Video Game Land a few months back where I went to Toys R Us and I saw how huge gaming IP, how huge of an influence gaming IP is being on kids today, that, you know, their heroes are Angry Birds now. And it's like, it's even bigger and more socially acceptable for kids to be playing digitally than it was when I was a kid and when I was into Sonic the Hedgehog. So it's like, now that we have all of these platforms that have incredibly low barriers to entry and sort of pay what you want business models, I'm really interested, in seeing how interactive entertainment becomes a larger part of social consciousness. You know, that so much of the ways that we express ourselves online and receive information online is so game-like anyway, that the thing that I am excited about and curious to see the result of is that games are becoming a modern language that is universal and that sort of transcends our identity issues about being nerds or whatever that we had when we were younger. Does anyone understand why we have an Xbox? Like, it's bigger than that now, because it's a language that people are using that is present everywhere. And you start to see the impact of interactive entertainment and experience design on, you know, every piece of hardware that comes out or every piece of software that people use in their everyday lives. And I'm finding that interesting. You know, I'm not interested in like gamifying real life or shoehorning game mechanics onto natural behavior, but in terms of interactivity as an everyday part of how people express themselves, communicate with one another, and entertain themselves, it's just exploding, and I'm really excited about that and curious about it.
I have 12-year-old twin brothers, and it's been really interesting. Like, they play a lot of video games, but just watching their I guess their perspective as people who, you know, video games have been around a lot longer than they have, and just seeing how it's just so normal for them and how easily they can play them on any platform, like on an iPhone or on a 360, or hearing their conversations about schoolyard politics, about who's allowed on whose Minecraft server. And it's really fascinating, because it's just part of their life. As Lee said, they're not, you know, they're not this other subculture almost. They just play games a lot, and so do all their friends. And it's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, like when I first started writing back in, you know, 2005 or something, like some of my earliest articles were like wondering about my place in the world as a gamer, and like bringing my DS around the city and seeing if there was anyone to play like Elite Beat Agents with. But it's just in such a short time that has become such a leftist, you know, such an irrelevant concern. Because like, for good or for ill, now I walk onto the subway and I see aisles of people with their faces in luminous screens tapping and playing something. And, you know, sometimes it unsettles me because I wonder what we're doing with our ability to reach that many people. And if we're providing the meaningful interactivity versus just distractionware. But, you know, going back to what we started talking about in terms of culture war, there are good reasons and, you know, there are good factors and bad factors in the fact that, games are like a major vein of humanity now, and we can't really ever go back from that. I mean, I'm curious about what is the place of the traditional console in this environment, but I guess we'll see.
Mm. Well, let's do a little fan service conversation, if you don't mind. Some questions that I think people will be particularly interested in. The consoles, this new set of consoles coming. Is there a future for game consoles? Will this be the last generation of consoles, in your opinion?
I think Lee's probably a lot better place to answer that than me, so I'll let her go first.
I think I could probably get a lot of money from Sony and Microsoft right now if I had a solid answer to that question. But it's definitely a question that's on a lot of people's minds. I mean, I think we'll have to see. I certainly would not want to be in charge of launching an expensive high-end home console into this current market where our attention is being divided among a lot of smaller devices, and where we're going to have internet-enabled TVs, and where we're going to have sort of boxes for our PCs where we can sort of stream things to all of the screens that we own. I am not really good at making predictions, so I'm going to steer clear of it, but it's definitely, I can confidently say, it's a much more challenging and complicated environment for consoles than we saw even with the last generation. You know, when Sony announced the PS4, I wrote about when they announced the PS3 and they said, this is going to be a living room all-rounder. It's going to play your devices and you're going to go on the internet with it. And everyone's like, why? That's just making it more expensive. We don't want that. We just want it to play games. And these days, there's no home hardware that could survive without being able to do more than one thing. So it's just, you know, do people still want AAA game software is the big question. And we've seen severe retail declines and severe risk aversion. And the audience that is making the purchasing decisions around AAA right now, I feel, are people like us who are adults, who are becoming parents, who, you know, have maybe happy nostalgic memories of the brands that we liked when we were young. But, you know, are we still going to be buying into more of the same? Are we still going to want to be like treasure hunters with guns or robot mans with guns? You know, like, so, and I think what would be useful for the console space is if they could sell the mass market audience on the idea that games are going to be complicated and immersive and rewarding and culturally relevant. Like, people subscribe to HBO because they know that they're going to want to talk about girls and Game of Thrones at the office and they want to be up on things. I don't know yet if the AAA development industry has convinced your average consumer that games can deliver them that experience that's going to be relevant to their lives that they're going to want to talk about. I see marketers still pitching to college boys. And I think if this is the last console generation, we can thank the marketing that has constrained the creative freedom of software development on consoles.
Yeah, I think for me, the issue, I guess, again, this is more of a cultural thing than an industry thing, is that every new console generation, you got all the marketing rhetoric of finally we have the technology and now it's only our imaginations that are limiting us. And you get that every generation for the last 20, 30 years. And for me, like, I felt like we weren't progressing to a technological place of the future anymore once we got to this generation. Like, for me, I felt like this generation was it. Like, the technology problem was solved and now we could just make games almost. Like, I played Bioshock when it was new and I just remember not pressing any buttons, waiting for the first opening movie to finish and then realizing it already had finished. So I'm like, okay, that's it. Technology's fine now. So, like, the issues of AAA games going forward, for me at least, aren't ones that better technology is going to solve. The issues are
agreed.
What kind of games they're making, and whether or not they can sell them to a average consumer and stuff. So so I don't really have excitement or hype about the new technology because it's not technology I need to solve what I want solved with AAA games.
And I think it's definitely a valid perspective that enhanced realism actually sort of diminishes the strength of design, which is, you know, in abstraction, in encouraging you to use your imagination and personify the space. And if you're just kind of guiding some creepy living puppet, like, if it passes a certain point where it's too real, you know, you're not going to be engaged by that interactive experience. If you want a passive experience, you're going to seek that out. So, yeah, I don't know if it continues to be relevant to focus on technology as the ultimate enabler of the things that we want to do. And it is worth saying that a lot of times when developers talk about that they want more tech, they don't necessarily mean more graphics or more realism. They want more space to do AI, more resources to create more complicated simulations. So we'll see if they can do that. But again, even if they can and they do it within the steampunk post-apocalyptic World War II gun thing that, again, we haven't convinced the rest of the world is relevant to their lives or hip or something that they would want to experience, it's still just going to be preaching to the choir. So, yeah. I think we have a communications challenge. That's something I feel super strongly about, especially right now when we actually have to go to Washington and be told by the government, well, we know games don't cause violence, but everyone else thinks they do. We have a horrible messaging problem right now in letting people know what experiences are waiting for them in games. And I think we need to broaden what's on offer in order to make an expensive console with expensive software appealing in a sustainable way.
You know, it's a very telling thing to me that these two big boxes, I'm sort of taking the Wii out of the picture in this past generation, but these two big boxes that this demographic you're describing, these college boys are buying, it's such an easy argument. One guy says in class, you know, Call of Duty is awesome, and eight guys buy it the next day, and they play it together, and this investment, this $300 investment, you want AAA experiences on the thing because you paid so damn much money for it.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas it's oddly sort of, it seems counterintuitive, but you've got this another box that's got another kind of set of games on it. PSN games, sort of, Journey would be a good example, the game that was sort of routinely held as the best game of last year. No one wants to buy a $9 game for a $350 console. Very few of my students do. And the odd thing to me is that I've written about that game, a lot of people wrote about it. It seems to me that among us, it's very notable. I talk about Journey, and I can't find a student of mine that's ever even heard of it.
That's so strange. I mean, even when it goes on, you know, national cable TV and wins awards and stuff, and Yeah, the interesting thing right now is that everyone in the industry is saying that in order to differentiate, the consoles are really going to have to court the indies. They're going to have really good channels with fresh, independently made content. Otherwise, it's just going to be the same disc-based software or same full-scale games, because no one's going to develop console exclusives anymore. But if it is all about the indies and the indies are not all about tech, then again, it calls into the question, it's like, what is a $300 or $400 console for if it's an indie channel, which is that's why I think probably people are becoming increasingly interested in, Android-based platforms and Linux-based platforms and things where they can have access to a channel of smaller games. I'm not sure, but yeah.
So I kind of ignored it until very recently, but I've only just started getting kind of interested in the, I don't even know how to pronounce it out loud, Ouya, whatever that console's called. I've never had to actually say it out loud before. The idea of actually having indie games in some capacity on my TV in front of a couch with a controller and not at my desk with a keyboard and mouse. I'm kind of interested in that idea because, don't tell anyone, but I'm not a big fan of playing games on a PC. I'm interested in that. Just because I'm on a couch when I play games.
You are out of the club, Brendan. That's it. So do you have time for one more question?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You're both bright, articulate people. You could spend your time writing about anything or pursuing anything. What is it that attracts you to games? What would make you stick around, if you know what the kind of question I'm asking? What is it that keeps you here, focused on this thing we're talking about?
Well, I don't know anything else, so that helps. I think in the last couple of years, I guess my interest is really in games has almost been superseded by my interest in writing about games, which is maybe why I have so many ridiculous arguments on Twitter too often. I think I'm really excited in this as a writer more than I am as a gamer or a player or whatever. And it's related to my PhD as well, which is how to do games criticism academically, essentially. I'm just really interested in all the ways we're trying to write about games, both on the journalism side and the criticism side of a spectrum, and all the different approaches we're trying, just all the types of writing that exist. So it's a little bit meta, but I think that's what I find most exciting about games, is how people are trying to write about them in all the different ways. I just find that really interesting.
Is that a self-contained thing, Brendan? That are you able to find that reward from the process that you're describing, or do you see yourself in service of something? I mean, is the function of criticism essentially to serve the art form, the medium, to advance it, or ultimately is that just a byproduct of whatever?
Well, I think, and of course, I'm biased to thinking criticism is important since I write it, obviously. But I think criticism in any medium serves an important role in not just for legitimization, but the maturing, I guess, of that medium. I think critics can help creators and an audience kind of find the words for things they already know. I think when I started reading games criticism before I was writing it, for people like you two, essentially, I'd read it and go, yes, that's exactly the thing I felt when I played that game and I didn't have the words for. So I think critics can find that vocabulary and build up those words for people and make a more literate audience, and in turn, maybe in this long run kind of way, more literate creators. And you kind of get this wheel rolling where criticism and creation work side by side and you get better stuff, hopefully. So I think there is a purpose to criticism. I don't think it's anything as straightforward as a critic says, this game should have done that, and the developer goes, oh, okay, how foolish of me, and they do it better in the sequel. I don't think criticism is that important or anything, but I think there is this kind of momentum you can build with a strong critical discourse between critics and creators that other mediums really benefit from, and I think increasingly games are benefiting from as well. So I think criticism is important, and I just enjoy writing. So they're probably the two main reasons I get really excited about it.
How about you?
It's a good question. Writing is the only thing I'm good at, and I'm interested in interaction design, and if I can continue to see games as having a role to play in a larger cultural concept. I definitely overstate my own relevance, but I like to feel like I have a duty to it and to the people that like it and the people that want the same things as me. And, it does get hard to keep out a lot of the times. audiences can be very challenging, you know, especially, you know, the more visible my work gets, it gets fatiguing. And, you know, I'm often disappointed when games do the same dumb things over and over. And, you know, I often ask myself, why do I do this? What do I like about it? But I guess I just care. And I have to believe it will all mean something someday. I don't know. Maybe that's kind of a bleak answer, but I also agree with Brendan in that I think that, that dialogue and conversation are important, and I'm proud to contribute to it.
Yeah, I do think you're right, though, and I think Brendan hit on this, too. There is something to be said for when someone helps us understand why we love something or why something matters to us, that we don't always know. It's just something that somehow we feel it, and that someone comes along. And maybe you've been in this position, too, as a writer or as an artist, that someone who seems to have a deeper understanding of the work will say something to you that unlocks your own understanding of your own work. And that's something, there's something incredibly valuable about that. And there might be only a handful of people in the world that are sort of capable of doing that for you at the moment that you need it to be done. And you just want to wrap your arms around those people. You know what I mean?
That may be close to why you do teaching as well, because it is a good feeling to help people learn and to understand things. And it's a way of experiencing, I don't know, intimacy with the world. You know, you feel like you're putting something good out there when you help people articulate feelings and interests, and when you sort of participate in that learning experience with someone.
Well, maybe we can stir a little bit more of that into Twitter.
Yeah. Well, maybe just not go on Twitter. So
well, this has been great. I'm very grateful for your time. I know this is a big, fat topic. It's impossible to really discuss it, you know, where you sort of solve it or wrap up all the loose ends. But I appreciate you kind of wrestling with it with me for a while. And you know, I appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. No, it's been great.
Of course. So do you want to let us know where we might find you next?
After I kind of burnt myself out last year writing a book in my spare time, which don't do, that was terrible. I'm trying to write better stuff less often, essentially, so better quality and less quantity. But I'm still writing maybe once a month or so on Unwinnable and Game Ranks occasionally, and occasionally just on my blog, Critical Damage, which is just critdamage.blogspot.com. But yeah, I'm around, but less so than last year. Yeah.
Unwinnable, I mentioned it at the beginning and you mentioned it. You want to just give them a shout out? I'm guessing maybe some of my listeners haven't quite yet discovered that terrific site.
Yeah, Unwinnable is just this excellent website for, I guess, essentially geek culture on large, like mostly video games and a bit of comics and general sci-fi stuff, but really good criticism, excellent writers. Brian Taylor's here occasionally, Jen Frank, everyone who writes there is excellent. And yeah, they just write really good pieces a lot. So it's just unwinnable.com, I think. That's where I probably am mostly these days. And they're great.
Yeah. It's a pretty simple formula. It's good writers writing about game culture or related issues to that culture.
It's very basic to write for as well. They're just so straightforward. You just write it, bam. It's edited enough. And yeah, it's just a great website. I'm really glad to be a part of it.
Well, I will link to that as well. And how about you, Lee?
Well, weirdly, the best place to keep up with all my links is to follow me on Twitter. I've been trying to eliminate the excessive personal tweets in favor of just promoting my work. Let me see. I'm giving a couple talks at GDC. I'll be on the One Reason to Be panel on the advocacy track along with Maddie and some other great folks. And I'll be giving one of Richard LaMartian's micro talks as well. So there's that. And I forgot to mention, I've been doing this ongoing letter series with Quentin Smith at Polygon, where we sort of try to discuss a game in the context of our own lives and our own experiences with it. And the letter format is obviously not for everybody, but we really enjoy it, and it's some of the work I'm proudest of right now. So there's that as well.
Yeah, you've done several of those letters. Those are really cool. I think that's a terrific idea.
Thank you. Yeah, I love doing them just because it's like I get to have an honest conversation with my friends, and my friends are usually super educated and super cool people. Like, it started when I did the FF7 letters with Kirk Hamilton, Quinns and I did some letters on Dyad at Gamma Sutra. Then we did some Far Cry 3 letters at Polygon, followed by some sort of Walking Dead adventure gamey letters at Polygon. And now the one we're working on is a secret, but I think a lot of our friends will like it.
Cool. I really tap into that conversation thing we were talking about earlier. especially over Final Fantasy VII ones and the Dyad ones, both excellent.
Thank you.
And it's really just get into things. You just can't do it in an essay. You just talk about them. And it's great.
Yeah. And that's sort of, it's in line with the values that I have in other people's writings right now, where, I like to talk about the game, but the game has context if it's informed by people's personal experience. So that's something I believe in and that I like to see in others.
Well, thank you very much. And I hope I can have both of you on again sometime soon. I'm going to try to get onto a more regular podcasting schedule. And if there's ever anything you'd like to chat about, let me know and we'll have you back on.
We'd love that. I mean, everybody loves your podcast, so I'm so pleased that you're doing a new series.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back.
Yay.
All right. Well, thanks, Lee, and thanks, Brendan. Best of luck to both of you. And I'll be seeing both of you at GDC. So
yay.
We'll lift a glass.
Will be. Yep.
Okay. Looking forward to it.
Take care.
Take care, gentlemen.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye.